Hi, everyone, and welcome to ABCs of Anesthesia podcast and on YouTube. Now, today we have Dr. Grant. So, Grant, I'll give a brief intro and then, just start some questions. But we're going to be talking about everything in bypass, which is really something that I think a lot of anesthetists just let happen because there's an expert there. But in your specific circumstance, you did a fellowship in this. So Grant, I mean, just to start from the very beginning, grew up on a farm in the west of Dalby, completed his medical training at James Cook University. He worked as a junior doctor in North Queensland, where he completed his Master of Public Health and Tropical Medicine and his introductory and basic anesthesia training, then moving to Brisbane for advanced anesthesia training, working between quite a few hospitals there. He then undertook a fellowship in cardiothoracic anesthesia and medical perfusion at the Princess Alexandra Hospital, with training in transesophageal echo, cardiopulmonary bypass, and ECMO, or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. Grant works now as a staff specialist at the PA Hospital, privately through several hospitals in Brisbane as well, and he maintains his interest in rural and regional anesthesia through his work on the DRGA, so that's the Diploma of Rural Generalist Anesthesia, as well as ANSCA. Now, that's actually how we met, Grant, so I'm really fortuitous that we met on that, but I've never met an anesthetist who does medical perfusion because that wasn't a thing. Welcome.
Yeah. Oh, thanks so much, Matt. I appreciate you having me and appreciate the intro. I've never been on a podcast before, so this is a new experience for me.
That's right. hey, so just to get started, now, what are the basics of cardiopulmonary bypass? Like, you know, what is this all about? Why are we actually doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. So cardiopulmonary bypass is a technique that was developed to pretty much does what it says on the tin, really, bypass the cardiopulmonary system, the heart and the lungs. And this allows surgeons to operate on the heart, and on the great vessels around the heart to, you know, remedy any pathology that's around them.
Yeah, right. And obviously there is the, like, you know, non-bypass cardiac surgery. But what's that about then?
Yeah, so there is new techniques developed to allow cardiac surgery to proceed without bypass. And it's sort of for specific surgeries or specific techniques where bypass perhaps isn't really required. So it has to be pathology and patient specific. So things like off pump coronary artery bypass grafting. So for simple bypass grafting cases where the amount of grafts that are needed or the anatomical location of the grafts is amenable to the surgeon operating on the surface of the heart without the heart being arrested and without blood flow being ceased to the chambers within the heart, then they can perform that off pump or without the use of cardiopulmonary bypass.
Just thinking about it, like, it must have been such a crazy advancement in science, because obviously all other parts of the body aren't moving really. There's a bit of diaphragmatic movement with breathing, but the heart is full of blood. It's constantly moving at a very fast rate. So this would none of this would be possible. Like, surgeons just couldn't quite get those stitches in
with the
movement, right?
Absolutely. And if you're interested in the history, actually, which is incredible because it happened, you know, within the last 70 or so years, this is within a lifetime that all this stuff has happened. There's an excellent book called King of Hearts by G. Wayne Miller that talks about Walt Lillehei in Minneapolis, who was one of the sort of pioneering cardiac surgeons in America who came up with this. And it reads like a fiction because some of this stuff that they do is unbelievable, but very trailblazing. And of course, it allows what we do today.
It's surprising that there isn't a Netflix movie on this, because this sounds like something that would be, you can just see the storyline, patient needs surgery on the heart, they don't know how to do it, this guy comes up with, let's just stop the heart.
Perfect, man, we can pitch it after this to Netflix, I reckon, this would be great.
Yeah, absolutely, we've got the rights on this story, don't we?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Hey, so we're bypassing the heart and the lungs, so obviously we need oxygenation and we need a pump, so, you know, let's get into a bit of the physiology. What is the oxygenation about?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you've correctly identified there that we need a pump. We need something to generate pressure to allow flow. And we need an oxygenator as well to oxygenate the blood. The other things that we need most simply are sort of a drainage line, which is in the form of a venous line, and then a return line, which normally goes in the aorta, the central cardiopulmonary bypass, but there are a range of configurations. It can also be peripheral as well in the femoral artery and femoral veins. But for the purpose of this conversation, we'll stick primarily to, say, central cannulation for something like a coronary artery bypass graft surgery. But you're absolutely right. So oxygenators are sort of a fantastic invention that's allowed extracorporeal oxygenation. Now, these work by sort of diffusion of oxygen through pressurized blood, flowing very, very close to polymethylpentene fibers within an oxygenator that allow diffusion across the fibers. Now, these have a much smaller surface area to the human lung, but because of the arrangement of the fibers, they still work very, very efficiently. So we can get quite a long life out of each oxygenator for each case, and they still provide very, very good oxygenation. This is a huge advancement from the original oxygenators, which were sort of helical glass structures that blood flowed down through, countercurrent to bubbles of oxygen that went up through the helical glass. They were called bubble oxygenators. So that's how they first started doing this. And obviously, we've come a long way since then in terms of efficiency and reliability with these oxygenators.
Right. I've got some stats from a BJA article saying like 200 millimeters is the distance in these oxygenators versus, 200 micrometers versus 10 micrometers distance. So, you know, much greater diffusion distances and, you know, around two to three square meters of surface area versus, 70 to 100 square meters in the human lung. So these are, massively different and disadvantageous profiles here. And if you think of the law of diffusion, this is not a great situation, but it still works well enough. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. And because the blood is pressurized as it goes through the oxygenator, and we get such good flow of that blood, it allows some diffusion across that membrane.
Yeah, and so that's the oxygenator. Essentially, you've got oxygen through a membrane. It's fixed law of diffusion all over again, and that allows enough oxygenation. How about the pump?
Yeah, so the pump itself can take a few different configurations. The first type of pump, and a commonly used type of pump, is what's called an occlusive type of pump or a roller pump. And this consists of sort of soft plastic tubing running through a raceway that then has two rollers on each end that rotate in a circular fashion. These will occlude the plastic tubing running through the pump, allowing displacement of the blood, and that's how force is generated with these occlusive pumps. These are in use commonly for cardiopulmonary bypass, and they're some of the first types of pumps that we used. There's also non-occlusive types of pumps, so things like a centrifugal pump. So these will allow input of blood through the top of a centrifuge. Centrifuge will rotate, creating velocity of the blood, and then have an output on the lower lateral side. These non-occlusive pumps have some advantages to occlusive pumps in that there may be less shear stress and trauma to red blood cells, platelets, etc. But they can reach, sort of similar flows depending on the type of tubing used in occlusive pumps and the type of non-occlusive pump used. Those are sort of the main two types of pumps used today.
It seems almost strange. Like you've got this plastic tubing and you're squishing it around. Obviously, that's going to cause trauma. That's going to cause problems. Like, is that a big problem? Is that something you have to fix?
Yeah. So occlusive pumps certainly, as I said, can cause a lot of shear stress and trauma to red blood cells and platelets. And it's kind of, as you might imagine, directly proportional to the amount of time that blood is spent moving through that tubing. So the longer the bypass run, the more potential trauma can be caused, the more potential hemolysis and platelet dysfunction we see once we wean from bypass that then needs to be fixed. It's also important, of course, to test the calibration of the occlusive pump. So if the pump was over-occlusive, then we may cause more trauma due to more crushing of that plastic and more crushing of those red cells and platelets. And of course, if it's under-occlusive, then we might not have proper occlusions and we might get retrograde flow, or the pump might not flow forward all of the time at low flows because of that under-occlusion.
Hey, so, just like we invoked, there's a few principles in the anesthesia. Fixed law of diffusion, area over, pressure gradient times area over thickness over square root of molecular weight times a diffusion coefficient is fixed law of diffusion. And Hagman-Purcell equation is the other very commonly invoked formula, which is pressure differential times pi r to the power 4 over 8 times viscosity times length. So really, this blood flow is dependent on pressure over resistance, or the Hagman-Purcell equation.
Absolutely, yeah. I think everything in medicine comes down to, Ohm's laws and maybe two other laws in there. That's about right. But yes, a cardiopulmonary bypass is no exception.
Okay, so great. So you've got an oxygenator, you've got a pump. The pump pushes the blood around. Now, this is something that always confused me, even doing anesthesia for these kind of cases, because I wasn't there directly, you know, being the surgeon who's putting the plumbing in. What do you what does a surgeon physically do to connect the drainage line and then the return line?
Yeah, sure. That's an excellent question. I'll say that, of course, in each institution, the specific logistics of how cardiopulmonary bypass is connected to the patient to the table will vary, similar to, you know, how the morgue controller will vary between your hospital and my hospital, but the basics are all pretty much the same. So I'll talk about it in sort of basic and general terms. But for central cannulation for a coronary artery bypass grafting surgery, I'd be remiss not to mention that before any of this occurs, we should have an adequate ACT. So we should be giving a heparin and we should be measuring that ACT, and we want to see that ACT over 480. So the reference range being 120 to 140, we want to have about 2.5 times to 3 times that. I know that wasn't the question asked, but it's really, really important that that gets done, because that's the thing that really gets perfusionists.
Actually, is that the thing? There's nothing else you need to really, really, really do right in anesthesia except get that heparin in and make sure the ACT is above 480.
Pretty much. I reckon if you can do that, then, you know, everything else can kind of get by. But that's the thing that's a non-negotiable.
And I probably want to highlight this. So, you know, I'm going to repeat this, because if there's, you know, you'll be potentially probably a basic trainee, maybe even at a crit care level, but definitely a lot of my advanced training was spent in cardiac theaters, and it really helps you getting all the lines and everything. And you do feel a little bit useless, because there's such complex patients. There's a lot going on. You know, the anesthetist, you know, the specialist is out there putting the toe in and really involved in that, and you're kind of doing all the other bits and bobs for the case, and that's the one thing that you need to get right. So just trust me when we say heparin is the one thing you need to get right. If you get this wrong, then everything else can go extremely, extremely wrong. Because I guess the point is, you give that standard dose of heparin. What is the dose of heparin that you give?
So about 300 to 400 units per kilo.
So 300 to 400 units per kilo, you give that dose. And if the if you're late on measuring the ACT and the surgeon's ready to go and you don't have that reading, that it looks like amateur hour. So you have
looks bad. Absolutely.
And what timing would you give the heparin? Like, you know, start a kiss.
So usually when the surgeon asks for it. So it depends, you know, particularly what the surgeon's doing for that specific surgery. But again, to say coronary artery bypass grafting with, say, maybe they're taking an internal mammary artery. Once they've harvested that internal mammary artery, usually some point then, if a vein graft is being taken as well, then they'll be ready to open the pericardium and insert their lines. And so usually they'll ask for heparin at that point. The heparin will be given 300 to 400 units per kilo, and then an ACT will be taken about 2 minutes after that. And it's something that, yeah, you don't want to forget. Often if the heparin's given and then you forget to take the ACT, and they look over the drafts and say, how long is that ACT gone? And you're going, oh, no.
And so when you say 300 to 400 units per kilo, it sounds like you should always err on getting a higher than low ACT. Would you ever just say, look, let's just give 400 units per kilo. We don't want to ever be lower.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Especially if the patients, if things are moving quickly, you know, if you want to get on bypass quickly, you'll sometimes just give a larger than usual dose just to ensure a margin of safety. Or if the patient may, you know, be at risk of heparin resistance or AT3 deficiency due to, say, being on a heparin infusion prior to coming to the theatre, say, for, you know, angina as an inpatient, then you'll certainly err on a higher heparin dose just to ensure that extra margin of safety.
Okay, let's talk about that. So someone's on a heparin infusion previously, and this would be pretty common. What dose are you giving then?
Yeah, so I'm giving straight 400.
Never 500, never going?
I'll normally give 400 and then check, and then I'm more than happy to give more as necessary if the ACT comes a little under what we're looking at. And that'll be a discussion between the perfusionist and the anesthetist, obviously keeping the surgeon aware as well. That you know, we're concerned about perhaps heparin resistance in this patient, and so we'll give higher doses.
Yeah, okay. What is the most resistance someone could be to heparin? Is there some kind of genetic disorder? Is there something else that people should look for in the history or on the investigation?
Yeah, so I mean, any known antithrombin 3 deficiency will be a big problem, because obviously, you know, heparin, an ionic mucopolysaccharide molecule that exerts its effects on 10A through antithrombin 3. So if there's any congenital deficiency that's known about, then that's something that's very concerning. And so you'd be starting at very high doses of heparin there. And once you've given significant doses up to, you know, 600 plus units per kilo, if you're still not getting an adequate ACT, you can think about potentially supplementing the patient's antithrombin 3 with either antithrombin 3 concentrate, depending on what your hospital and lab has available, or FFP, because we know that antithrombin 3 still have a certain concentration in fresh frozen plasma. So we can give patients a unit of fresh frozen plasma, check the ACT again, and sort of see how they're traveling with respect to anticoagulation.
And there's not some kind of routine screening that people get done, as far as I remember. You're not screening.
No, it's fairly rare to have an antithrombin 3 deficiency. So nothing routine.
Okay, how about heparin allergy?
Yeah, heparin allergy. So luckily, I've not had to see that yet. Heparin anaphylaxis is overwhelmingly kind of rare, which is good. But then, of course, the paradigm shifts a little bit, such that we can't give heparin, and so we have to use other anticoagulation drugs. So the common one that's discussed is a direct thrombin inhibitor, or bivalirudin, which is a taken from hirudin, which is in the leech saliva that the leeches use. So bivalirudin, if you've got a known heparin allergy, talking to hematology pre-case, I might say, in that case, it's not something that you want to organize on table. But you're talking to your hematology colleagues to access the bivalirudin. You're giving a bolus dose and then an infusion dose of bivalirudin. It's got a relatively short half-life. You're doing that. You're checking your ACT, and some hospitals use an Ekerin clotting time as a laboratory test to measure the anticoagulation secondary to bivalirudin. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the question becomes at the end of the case, if we're not giving protamine, which is what we normally give for heparin to reverse the anticoagulation and ensure the patient has hemostasis at the end of the operation, there's no specific reversal agent for bivalirudin. So we need to stop that infusion. And it's got a half-life, as I said, about 20, 25 minutes, short half-life. So we sort of need to wait for that just to kind of wear off.
Oh, wow. Okay. Protamine and salmon have cross-reactivity. Is that right?
Yeah, so there's always a bit of a concern about increased risk of protamine anaphylaxis if there's, anaphylaxis to seafood, salmon. There's also could be a risk in males who've had vasectomies, if there's been exposure to sperm to the blood, breaking that blood barrier. Mm. Those are always things that you just keep in the back of your mind when you're administering protamine.
Mm, okay. And with heparin allergy, is there any kind of cross-reactivity with other drug allergy? So,
not that I know of, though perhaps we'll have an immunologist listening that could inform us better. But nothing comes to mind for me.
Okay, I think that's good. So, really, biggest take home of this whole podcast is get the heparin in, get the ACT right above 480 heparin dose, 400 units per kilogram, and I've not seen this. If you really need the, if you really have heparin anaphylaxis patient, bivalirudin. Get the leeches out, get the hematology.
Get the leeches out. Yeah. Phone a friend. Absolutely. But yes, that's absolutely right. And sorry, I went a little bit off piece there because you're asking what the.
That was the second question, actually. So,
yeah.
No, that's good.
Fantastic. So, yeah, I can answer you first with respect to configuration and what the surgeon will do to ensure that we can go on bypass. But as you said, we need a drainage line and we need a return line. Those are sort of the important things to ensure that the main circuit of bypass is connected. And so once our ACT is normalized and, we've got everyone ready to go, the surgeon normally asks if everyone's happy for aortic cannulation. So the surgeon will place purse strings within the aorta, ascending aorta, and these will allow, at the end of the case, the hole that's created for the cannula to be closed with the minimum of bleeding. So they'll place these purse strings, ask if everyone's happy for aortic cannulation, which is sort of asking if the ACT is good and that the arterial blood pressure is amenable to cannulation. And normally we're looking at an arterial blood pressure of less than 100 systolic, and that's just to decrease the risk of aortic dissection. Obviously, if we try to stick a fairly large cannula into an aorta with a pressure of 200, then the risk of dissection will increase significantly and your operative time will be directly proportional to that.
To the ruptured aorta, yes.
Exactly, yeah. You've got a lot more work to do that
just
day.
Just to clarify, so they're doing some sutures, they're not cutting open, but they're doing it in a circular fashion around the aorta, and that allows the needle to go in, and then once it's out, immediately get clamped.
Correct, yeah. So just on the surface of the aorta is where those purse strings go, and then they'll make that small incision in the aorta, which allows them to place the aortic cannula. Mm-hmm. Once the aortic cannula is placed, of course, we want to make sure that it's in the right place. And that's where the perfusionist comes in a little bit. So the surgeon will connect the arterial line that's sitting at the table that the perfusionist control with their pump to the aortic cannula that's in the aorta. And that's normally done with the use of an underwater seal, either by the perfusionist flowing up on their line to ensure that there's no bubbles in the line. And that's a team sport as well. Everyone needs to be looking at that point to ensure there's no bubbles and no risk of emboli coming up that line. So they'll connect that. The perfusionist will examine the pressure in the aortic line, ensuring that it's the same as the arterial pressure on the radial line as well, and ensure that they can flow normally with that line, basically making sure it's in the right place, that there's no kinks, no obstruction to that, that it's not sitting up against the wall of the aorta. Similar to, you know, flushing a cannula. When we put a cannula in the back of the hand, we want to give it a little flush, make sure it's not up against anything. This one, of course, is in the aorta, though, so the stakes are a little higher. But the perfusionist will get involved in that, make sure that aortic line is working and working well. And once that's working well, the surgeon will move to the venous line or the drainage line. And so for the central configuration of bypass, they'll again put purse strings in the right atrium, make a small incision in the right atrium, and then usually put a cannula into the right atrium. It's a two-stage cannula, single-stage cannula, two-stage operations that will then drain blood from the IVC and the SVC into the pump. And then we're ready to initiate cardiopulmonary bypass.
Yeah, right. And the cross clamp is just above the aorta. And the aortic cannula is just above that cross clamp. That stops any backflow into the coronary arteries.
That's right. Yeah. So for example, for a coronary artery bypass grafting surgery, once the surgeon's happy with all of their grafts, they're ready to go in terms of that they can donor from the saphenous vein in the leg. They'll examine that, and then we'll initiate cardiopulmonary bypass. Once bypass is initiated, there's sort of a period there, and this is probably the second thing for the anaesthetist to be specifically aware of. There'll be a period there where the patient is on bypass, so we're draining blood out of the KV into the reservoir through our pump and oxygenator back into the arterial line. But the patient still has normal electrical function of the heart, and so at that point, if there's any issues with cardiopulmonary bypass, the patient says, actually, look, guys, I've got a problem here. They can simply return the blood back to the aorta and the patient's native circulation is still intact. So at this point, we're sort of running with two circulations. We've got the extracorporeal circulation that's providing most of the flow, in fact, all of the flow if you're on full bypass. But then you've still got the patient's native circulation intact. And usually at this point, the surgeon will place an aortic root vent. So this is a small cannula that allows venting of the aorta between the aortic valve and where the cross clamp will go. And this is to help drain the aorta in that region of any blood, or to help fill it with blood, which may help attaching their grafts or ensuring flaccidity of the aorta at the end of the case. Following that, then the cross clamp goes on. So the cross clamp will go, as you said, sort of proximal to the aortic cannula, close to the aortic valve, but above the aortic root vent. And so we need a sort of flaccid aorta at that point. And so the perfusionist will decrease the pressure in the aorta by decreasing flow. The aortic cross clamp will be placed. And following that, then we can commence cardioplegia and arresting and protecting that heart and myocardium.
Okay. I think that all makes sense. It really is just anatomy and logic to this. You've got the clamp,
100%.
You've got the aortic cannula above, below you've got a vent. You've got the valve there. You can fill up that spot, that place between the valve and the clamp with blood or take blood away.
Yes.
And your cardioplegic solution is probably the next thing to talk about, goes into that vent.
That's it. Yeah. So there's a few methods of delivery of cardioplegic solution. So there's sort of antegrade, retrograde, and osteal, which is a form of antegrade. So antegrade cardioplegia is exactly what you're describing there. It's when the perfusionist will give cardioplegia through the aortic root vent. And that, if you think conceptually, is as I said, sort of distal to the aortic valve, but proximal to the clamp. That will pressurize your aortic root. And assuming that you've got a competent aortic valve, so that you don't get retrograde flow into the left ventricle, pressurize that section of the root, and which the coronary ostia are coming off for your left main and your right coronary artery, you'll get antegrade flow of cardioplegic solution down those coronary arteries, which will then arrest your myocardium. And so if you've got a competent aortic valve, then antegrade cardiac bleeding solution and antegrade cardiac bleeding delivery is what's favored as it seems to get the best myocardial protection.
Excellent. And with the cardiac bleeding solution, I mean, it is a bit crazy. You're literally giving a cardiac arrest dose of potassium and a few other agents. What is this solution? What's the combination?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a few different types of cardioplegia solution. So St. Thomas's is the one that's commonly used. And this is, as you say, a sort of hyperkalemic solution. There's a few other electrolytes in there. So, you know, concentrations of sodium chloride, calcium, magnesium, usually bicarbonate. Sometimes lignocaine is added to try and decrease the risk of any arrhythmia coming off pump. But St. Thomas's hyperkalemic cardioplegia is the most common type used. Mm. There's a couple of different types. It's called Del Nido and Brett Schneider cardioplegia, which are sort of different ratios and different balances. As you can imagine, in medicine, everyone thinks they can do things a little bit better than the other guys, so they'll change it up a little bit. And these are used in certain cases to achieve different lengths of myocardial protection due to the individual constituents of those agents. But the St. Thomas's hyperkalemic one is the most common one used. And as you say, it's predominantly focusing on hyperkalemic concentration to induce a diastolic arrest and protect that myocardium. And I should mention too, that's often mixed with oxygenated blood as well. The thought being that some amount of oxygenated blood will allow delivery of oxygen into the myocardium while it's arrested and just sort of having some oxygen around rather than purely crystallization, which of course has minimal oxygen. And so, of course, even at arrest, the heart will have a basal metabolic rate. And so the theory being that some oxygen around will be useful.
Hmm. And is it always a cold solution? There's obviously not deep hypothermic circulatory arrest. This is making the heart a little bit colder because that might decrease the BMR, basal metabolic rate?
Absolutely, yeah, you're absolutely right. So, in my institution for cardioplegic solutions, we always deliver at 4 degrees, and this is sometimes accompanied by the surgeon pouring cold water over the heart as well to achieve some decreasing temperature as well. And you're exactly right, decreasing that basal metabolic rate. We know from our studies of deep hypothermic circulatory arrest that we get about a 7% decrease in oxygen consumption for every degree of tissue cooling that we achieve. And so if we can keep the heart nice and cold, as well as inducing diastolic arrest, we really slow down all of the sodium potassium ATPases, help protect those mitochondria, ensure that the myocardium is in the best state possible for when we need to start it back up again.
Okay. You know, there was something they talked about when I trained, which is that this one of the surgeons, they talk about him being kind of the grandfather of cardiac surgery in Melbourne, perhaps, or even in Australia, I'm not sure. But yeah. What they say about him was that he wasn't necessarily the best surgeon, but he was an incredibly fast surgeon. And so whatever he lacked in a little, obviously he's very skilled, but a little bit of technical ability, he was so quick that the bypass times were always short and he got really good outcomes because of that. What is your sense of that, just the speed and how important that is to get off bypass quickly?
Super important, absolutely important. So the two big indices we look at are the total bypass time and the total cross-clamp time, because that is, of course, the time that the heart is not perfused for that cross-clamp time. And there's very good data to show that with increasing cross-clamp time and increasing bypass time, we have all of the really bad effects of bypass more commonly. So these are things like RV dysfunction, which is a really major concern with long bypass cases, even LV dysfunction as well, things like vasoplegia and things like significant coagulopathy all increase with increasing indices at those times. So it's an independent measure of potential complication. That, yeah, if you can reduce those, then that's fantastic.
And let's say the difference, so cross-clamp, increasing cross-clamp time versus increasing bypass time. So cross-clamp time will always be longer than bypass time, but is there some kind of sense of the outcomes of one versus the other?
So cross-clamp time will be shorter because we'll initiate bypass first, and then once we're happy with bypass, we'll put on that cross-clamp. Yeah. Once we're ready to come off, we'll take off that cross-clamp, and we're still on bypass while we're sort of getting the heart going again. Depending on what's going on sort of during that bypass time, if the heart's being perfused normally, with warm blood while the cross clamp's off, then there's sort of less complication that will go along with that bypass time compared to having cross-clamp on, of course, any increase in bypass time as a whole is bad, because then we're getting that complications of putting blood through a roller pump where we're using an extracorporeal circuit, exposing blood to membranes that it shouldn't be exposed to. Even though the heart's being perfused and the myocardial protection might be a little bit better once the cross clamp's off and we're just on regular bypass, we're still getting all of those negative effects of having blood exposed to an extracorporeal circuit.
Yeah, okay. Excellent. So we've talked about the most important thing, which is heparin, but is there anything else we should know as an anaesthetist? You know, you're a trainee training in this cardiac center, you've got your CAGs or your valve operations. Is there anything else that seems really important, things that come up time and time again that you wish you'd known earlier when you started?
Yeah, so I think the the biggest takeaway, in addition to the heparin, is that cardiac surgery is a team sport. And it's really just important to know what the other players in that team sport are doing at different times. And the really intense periods are those periods where we have to interface heavily with our surgeon, with our perfusionist, surgeon and perfusionist, anaesthetist and perfusionist, anaesthetist and surgeon. And so you just want to know what your other team player is doing during that time. And so sort of familiarizing yourself as quick as possible with your individual surgeon steps for coming on and going off bypass, and familiarizing yourself with how the perfusionist comes on and goes off bypass. And the things that we can directly influence as anaesthetists are things like we've mentioned the heparin, but I mentioned the systolic blood pressure at the time of aortic cannulation. So having that as less than 100 is very important. And a lot of surgeons, simply won't cannulate the aorta if the blood pressure is at that height. And so ensuring that you're, we mentioned if you're sort of waiting around for an ACT following the heparin, that's a problem. And then the blood pressure's high and you're waiting around for that as well. And, it's these sort of things that you can really help optimize to make the operation move slickly. Similarly, coming off bypass, you'll want a systolic blood pressure of less than 100 to remove the aortic cannula as well, to decrease any risk of dissection. And you'll want to know what your perfusionist is doing as well. Normally, the perfusionist will try and transfuse some of the blood left in the pump back through the aortic cannula before it's removed. And so controlling the pressure around those times is very important. The sort of individual flow of that will depend on the institution and depend on the surgeon and perfusionist you're working with. But being aware of those things will really help you be a team player and really ensure that things move as smoothly as possible.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. So, and in terms of blood pressure, I can imagine usually when the blood pressure gets a bit too high, it's often a temporary thing. I just give a bit more propofol or run a bit more volatile, maybe some more fentanyl. And is that generally what you do, or are you there actually giving beta blockers? And
I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's in sort of the classic way of anesthesia, there's no correct antihypertensive to give. Yeah, that's it, the one in your hands, absolutely. As long as you're giving something that works relatively quickly. For beta blockers, for example, I'd be careful giving something, a long-acting beta blocker, because then, of course, if you're coming off pump and that inotropy, then you could be in a bit of trouble. It's just using something short-acting to achieve that, whatever that may be, whether that's, propofol, volatile, magnesium, BTN, whatever you like. Yeah.
Actually, just to reiterate that, giving long-acting beta blockers in this situation, not great. You want definitely positive inotropy as you're coming off bypass.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's the great irony of bypass is that, you need a profound anticoagulation at 1 minute, and then the next minute you want everything to clot perfectly. It's the same as the heart. You want absolute hypotension at one point, but then you need perfusion the next second. So giving short-acting things is generally a good strategy.
Yeah, because that's really, it's almost reassuring. Like, I know you have to go through extra fellowship training, toe training. You've done your bypass training and ECMO training, but really when you're there, you've got often a very, very sick heart, or, especially if it's, the cardiomyopathies, having the, complex VAD operations or valves, really, severe valves plus heart failure. Mm. But, often it is just a acute coronary syndrome and the patient is okay. And if you get the blood pressure stuff right, the heparin and ACT right, as a trainee, I think, you're a long way to just doing really well in that section or that in that case or that rotation.
Absolutely. And if you can, if you're doing all those things well and you're even grasping, a little bit of the stuff we're talking about, because it's obviously a very busy time, then you're doing great. That's absolutely right. Yeah, doing fantastic.
The other stuff I wanted to know, I remember looking at, essentially when you're on bypass, it's non-pulsed high flow. You just have this blood pressure and then the flow as generated by the bypass machine, probably regulated by the perfusionist. Often the blood pressure line would go down to around 50 or 60, and in my mind, I was like, oh, is this right? So, do you care too much about pressure if you have enough flow generation?
Yeah, that's such a good question. So the interplay between flow and pressure is sort of complex and difficult to, there's been a lot of studies about this and what the optimum flow, what the optimum pressure is. So you've correctly identified, I think that pressure is not flow, and we get really used to as anaesthetists equating the two, because we often look at blood pressure as a surrogate of flow. And we know that, certain organ beds will auto-regulate at certain pressures to ensure a good flow. And so when we're anaesthetizing a patient for a lap appendix or a lap colic, we'll use our blood pressure as our surrogate for organ perfusion and organ flow. Now, it's a little bit different when we're on bypass, because we have so many more indices to look at. We can, as you say, dial up a specific flow on our pump. We can look at the oxygenation of the blood and calculate, using our oxygen flux equation, the delivery of oxygen that's going through our arterial line into the patient. We can index this to the patient's body surface area, and we come out with an indexed delivery of oxygen equation. The question becomes, of course, what is the best flow to give? I'll talk about pressure first, and then I'll come back to that, I suppose. But with respect to perfusion pressure, the equation is the exact same. It's just Ohm's law again, I suppose, that blood pressure is equal to cardiac output times your systemic vascular resistance. That's the same as perfusion pressure, just equal to your pump output multiplied by your systemic vascular resistance. As you've said correctly, there's a few sort of subtle differences. We normally have pulsatile flow in regular patients. And so systemic vascular resistance has components of, arterial elastance, reflection of pressures, inertia of blood, whereas that's not the case on bypass. It's mostly a non-pulsatile flow line delivered by the pump. We are able to deliver some pulsatile flow by certain pumps will have settings to be able to do this, but it doesn't seem to improve outcomes, so people don't really do it. But we deliver non-pulsatile flow, and so systemic vascular resistance sort of becomes a function of just pure friction of blood moving through arteries, plus a really important thing that we often forget about but is important for cardiopulmonary bypass is the viscosity of blood. So viscosity we know affects systemic vascular resistance, but at 36 to 37 degrees in normothermic patients like we have, it's mostly relatively unchanging. If your hematocrit's 25 to 35, probably going to be relatively similar and won't affect your systemic vascular resistance as much as say drugs or neural or hormonal regulatory factors will. On bypass, of course, we vary the temperature of our patient quite significantly, such that the viscosity of blood at a hematocrit of about 40 at a temperature of 37 degrees is pretty much equal to the viscosity of blood at a hematocrit of 25. When we get the patient down to 25 degrees. Now, we don't cool the patient for every case, mind you, for things like for CABGs and cases like this. We'll sort of use a tepid bypass at 35-ish degrees. And so that might not be a factor, but once we're doing larger cases with deep hypothermic circulatory arrest, viscosity becomes a significant proportion of our systemic vascular resistance. And so we have to take that into account. Oftentimes, we do get a significant amount of hemodilution once we go on pump because we prime the pump with crystalloid solutions, but we can also prime the pump with blood solutions. And so we need to think about viscosity when looking at systemic vascular resistance. So that's sort of one part of the equation, I guess, systemic vascular resistance when we're talking about perfusion pressure. The other part is pump output, and that's easily varied by just changing how fast the pump is running. So that's the beauty of perfusion, I guess, is that we can control that a little bit easier than we can control cardiac output in a normal patient. And so then the question becomes, I suppose, what kind of perfusion pressure do we target? And there's been a lot of studies on this, and there's sort of not one consensus because different regional circulations, as we know, auto-regulate at different pressures, and this may be affected by temperature, if we're cooling the patient significantly, and may be affected by sort of other interplays of bypass as well. And so it becomes a little bit tricky. What perfusion pressure do we target? Great question. Somewhere between 60 to 80 is probably what most people do. Sometimes dropping down to 50 is not so bad because we'll still be getting good autoregulation to the brain, which is obviously the main organ we're concerned about. And there's good studies to show that regional circulation to the brain and regional autoregulation of the brain remains intact for different carbon dioxide tensions, regardless of temperature. Mm. In fact, it might be a little bit left shifted. So I think 50 to 150 is the, or maybe 60 to 160 are the numbers that people commonly remember for the primary exam in terms of what flow is maintained, regardless of, you know, pressure delivered to the brain. So that might be slightly less shifted in bypass, so maybe 40 to 140-ish. And so those lower flows, lower pressures, sorry, we're ensuring that the brain is still perfused well.
Hey, so interesting. 60 to 80 as a map reading or the arterial line reading on non-pulsatile flow is reasonable. Why wouldn't you just aim at 80 to be sure?
Yeah, I mean, you could, but of course, you might get sort of more more complications, more bleeding. You'll often have to run your pump faster or deliver certain drugs to achieve that. And of course, that becomes the second part of the conversation, is that pressure is not the only determinant, as you said. Yeah. Pressure is just what we use as a surrogate. And because we can see our flow and calculate our delivery of oxygen, then we have to look at flow as well. So looking at pressure, if we just took pressure into account, and I guess to augment an analogy with a significant amount of hyperbole, if we had an aortic cannula in the aorta and then a cross clamp distal to that, and somehow measured the pressure in there, then that pressure would be pretty good at a really, really low flow. What I'm saying is our systemic vascular resistance is extremely high, then even at small flows, our pressure will be good. But that obviously doesn't ensure that we've got good delivery of oxygen to tissues. And so, as you've correctly identified, that's where kind of flow comes in as well. Mm. And so what flow is the correct flow? That's a great question as well. So I suppose if we look at our outcomes that we're trying to achieve is an adequate delivery of oxygen to meet oxygen consumption. So adequate DO2 versus VO2. Mm. The question becomes then, what's the VO2 in a patient who's anaesthetized, paralyzed at 34, 35 degrees? Really difficult question.
Isn't the answer less than one met?
That's right. Not a lot is the answer. Not a lot, yeah. So we can use a lot of indices to help estimate this. So we can look at our venous oxygen saturations compared to the amount of oxygen we're delivering. And that's, of course, the fixed floor as well, to help calculate our consumption of oxygen. But this is a little bit fraught because, of course, if we're not perfusing certain regional circulations that well, then we won't have oxygen uptake. And we might think that we're delivering a good delivery of oxygen because our saturated venous sats are normal or high, when in fact we're simply not perfusing an organ at all or not perfusing it adequately. Hmm. And so we can use other indices as well. We can use lactate, we can use pH. And we can use end organ monitors as well. So the NERS is something that's used somewhat controversially at times, near infrared spectroscopy, looking at brain perfusion and ensuring that we've got a relatively good brain perfusion by extrapolating from saturation of oxygen in the brain. And looking at things like urine output to ensure that, you know, we're still perfusing the kidneys, so they're still performing the function that they're doing.
I think the sound went out there, but yeah, just look at urine output, make sure we're perfusing the kidneys, NERS or near infrared spectrometry.
So that can sort of be indicators of adequate DO2 in the face of VO2. As I said, venous saturations can be useful, but they're really only useful if we get a really low venous saturations. Then we know that our oxygen uptake is significant, which means either our delivery of oxygen is inadequate or our consumption of oxygen has increased significantly, and so we need to vary one of those. Putting all of it together, it seems that studies show that flows of somewhere between 2.2 to 2.4 liters per minute per meter squared is ideal. And then, you know, pressure is kind of in that 60 to 80, aiming at a MAP of maybe 70-ish is ideal. So if we can achieve both of those things by varying our SVR and ensuring our flows are at that 2.2 to 2.4 liters per minute per meter squared, then most of the time we'll be ensuring that our perfusion is adequate.
What's an average kind of body surface area, just to get some whole numbers in there?
There's a whole bunch of formulas to calculate body surface area, but the Dubois formula is probably the most commonly used. It's one of these formulas that has like kilos to the power of 0.076, and, you know, plug it into a calculator, don't bother trying to work it out.
Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, that's it. But somewhere between sort of 1.5 to 2.5 are the numbers we see the most.
Okay, yeah, 1.525, meaning that your flow rates are roughly what you'd expect, like 5 liters per minute type thing?
Correct, yeah. Yeah, the flow rates that we commonly see are, you know, between 4 and 6 liters per minute on the pump.
Okay. Hey, I mean, in the last, I think, maybe go for another 10 minutes, but I really wanted to get onto the whole crashing onto bypass. You know, there's the old joke that cardiac anesthesia is easy. It's just half an anesthetic. You put them to sleep. You don't even have to wake them up. So
easy. That's it.
You get some sick hearts though. And, you know, induction time is a time that's, you know, again, fraught with massive cardiovascular changes. That's assuming you don't have any problems with oxygenation and your airway management and everything else that can kind of go wrong. Crashing onto bypass is the thing where I think they talk about, look, if things go wrong, you just crash onto bypass, easy, patient is safe. What's your perception of this, and have you had to do it? Have you?
Yeah. Certainly been done, and certainly doable. I think the important takeaway is that you have to do it kind of pragmatically. So if you've planned to do it, if you've discussed it with the team, then it's certainly something that's achievable. So if you've identified a patient, say you've got a redo patient, so they've had a previous sternotomy, we're entering the chest again, and it's potentially a hostile re-entry because of
adhesions.
Adhesions, and because there's scarring all through the chest. Then that would be a time, for example, that a potential crash onto bypass is something that might need to be done. And so if you're pragmatic with your approach, it certainly can be done. And I think pragmatism in this case means that the surgeon's aware that this is a potential option, as well as the anaesthetist and the perfusionist, that you have a primed pump in the room as well as a perfusionist in the room as well. And that in the time when the surgeon's setting up to go onto bypass, because, of course, say you're doing that redo sternotomy and your sternal sore ruptures the right ventricle. In the time between rupturing that right ventricle and potentially crashing onto bypass, you're obviously going to have pretty significant blood loss. And so you need the members of the team to ensure that there's something in place to ensure some amount of perfusion during that time. So often the anaesthetist will have 4 units of packed red cells in the room, just in case. We'll have a cell saver set up for the surgeon to use. And if you're really concerned, you can almost sort of put steps in place to ensure that the crashing onto bypass is a little bit quicker. So say putting wires into the femoral artery and the femoral vein in case there's, say, a rupture of that right ventricle like I was talking about, quickly put cannula into the femoral artery, femoral vein, jump onto bypass and go for it. So if it's sort of done pragmatically and the team's aware, then absolutely an option. If it's one of those things where, you know, you're playing a bit fast and loose and after it just goes wrong, we'll crash onto bypass, then, you know, you're sort of looking at, if there's no pump in the room, the perfusionist isn't there, there's no pump set up, you're looking at maybe 20 minutes or so before that happens. And so
is it
becomes a bit dicey. Yeah.
Everything set up, everything ready. What's the time frame between disaster and bypass?
Yeah, remarkably quick time. So say we had those wires in the groin, or even if we didn't wires in the groin and there was that RV rupture, we're talking, you know, a minute or two, really. Have our scrub nurses ready with all of the equipment, surgeon bangs those lines in, and then the other issue is, of course, anticoagulation, because we don't have time to test and wait for an ACT in that case. And so the anaesthetist will often give a large bolus of heparin, the perfusion will give a large bolus of heparin to the pump, and then we all hope that it works really well.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that was a particular example of, like, say, a redo sternotomy causing a, you know, rupture of the right ventricle or whatever. How about, you know, patients got a really sick heart, induction causes. This feels like it's really rare, because I think the sicker the patient is, the less you need of anything, really, to get them
absolutely
to sleep. But sick heart, induction of anesthesia, patient arrests or peri-arrest, you know, severely compromised. Is that also a doable thing?
For sure. And again, it's just that it's about the pragmatism at the time, just about correct patient identification. So if you've got a, you know, left main that's at 99% with significant segmental wall dysfunction and an EF of 10%, then you know, you're going to have everyone in the room ready to go at the time of induction. It's not, you know, drink in juice while you're out getting coffee kind of thing. So it's that sort of case. So it really comes down to correct patient identification and getting the team on board and ensuring everyone has a sort of shared mental model of what's going on.
Okay. And again, the time frame, that everyone's ready, you're about to do the anesthetics and not sternotomy is not even there yet. Bypass time from induction arrest to bypass. What do you reckon?
Yeah, again can be minutes depending on the type of configuration that the surgeon uses. So peripheral or central, if you're using a peripheral configuration, getting some wires and cannulae in can be very, very rapid.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay. No, that's really, really interesting to know. Have you had, you know, when things go wrong, I think is like there's this whole machine there, you know, bypass circuitry. How is it just doesn't fail? Like this is like extreme good redundancy, good technology, zero fail rates. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. I mean, it's absolutely right on those first accounts. Very, very good redundancy, very, very good technology. These things are engineered extremely well. I often use the analogy of, you know, airplanes. That it's sort of like a really well-engineered airplane, but Boeing probably proved me wrong in the last couple of weeks with respect to that. I'll stop using that analogy. they're very well-engineered pieces of equipment that are sort of regularly serviced. But are very well-serviced. And it's sort of about ensuring the safety checks and sort of the safety culture of perfusion is in place for these machines. So again, if you're playing fast and loose and not adhering to the specific sort of protocols of your institution, you'll probably find yourself in trouble. But if you're doing everything that should be done at the right time and ensuring that, you know, you're sort of there early to make sure that the pumps are ready to go, that you've checked things that can go wrong, then normally the equipment is very reliable in itself, and it would be extremely rare to have, you know, an oxygenator failure, though of course it does happen from time to time. And so then difficulties can arise, say, for example. So, for elective, you know, cases, then that's all fine and well and good. But say you're weaning from bypass or something and part of the pump was, you know, not primed, or say certain sensors are turned off to prepare for packing up the pump, and then you had to crash back onto bypass for some reason, say the RV failed because it got some air through the right coronary or something like that. That's sort of the time when you have to not only ensure that your safety checks are in place, but just be sort of very vigilant and present of mind for any kind of booby traps that you might have set for yourself in the pump.
Yeah, okay. Hey, so have you had any just real kind of moments where you're like, man, that was a scary experience. We had to do something a bit outside of the plan, or you followed a set of procedures extremely well. Any just like very harrowing experiences that kind of resulted in a pretty good outcome regardless?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of things, you know, perfusion is kind of analogous to anesthesia in that 99% of the time you're just going through the motions doing the things that you do every day. And then 1% of the time you're absolutely scared out of your mind. And so, yeah, that's certainly the case. And, you know, we've certainly had some of those examples. The one that I gave before of coming off bypass and sort of everything going well, in the first instance, the heart looks like it's functioning well, you know, surgical things that good, the toes looking great, the valve repair's gone well, whatever it might be. Had a few cases of that happening. You're sort of getting the pump ready to be wheeled back into the room and dismantled, and then something goes wrong and having to rush the pump back in, connect back up to the patient. Talked about those big boluses of heparin straight into the pump so the patient's not anticoagulated, that you've tested anymore, and so you're crashing back on, and, you know, suddenly your heart rate's through the roof and wow. You're dreaming of those days when everything went smoothly.
Yeah, and that's why they pay you the big bucks. I do remember a lot of these cases. You know, you talk about these cases like the 99% left main occlusion plus severely compromised ejection fraction of like 10%. You know, I've had a few cases over the years where it's not it's not acute coronary syndrome, but it's more of a, you know, just chronic heart failure, cardiomyopathy type situation where the LV EF is anywhere from 10 to 15%. I mean, you know, we just got through those cases, you know, running adrenaline, running, having ephedrine and metoprolol on hand, giving literally nothing, just midazolam, rock, and a massive dose of fentanyl, but, you know, this groin dissection kind of case. We get through that induction, but is there a number there? Again, obviously it's very hard because every patient is different, but let's say, for an example, just an elderly male, severe cardiomyopathy, EF 10%. Oh, sorry. What EF in that kind of situation would you say, look, this is extremely, extremely dangerous. Like this is a 99%, this patient will need bypass or some kind of level of like mechanical support that your drugs won't be able to give in a non-cardiac setting. Do you have a sense of that?
In a non-cardiac setting, probably not. I think I'd be more than happy to, you know, run patients for the sort of more minor cases on low EFs without extracorporeal support. And of course, patient selection is a really important thing for ECMO in those cases. And ensuring that there's a good indication, there's a good plan in terms of, you know, ECMO as a bridge to what exactly.
This is a totally, like a patient comes in, bad heart for urgent non-cardiac procedure, but is there like an EF that you just go, yep, that's too dangerous. I wouldn't touch this except in a cardiac setting with ECMO, bypass, whatever, ready.
No, not really. I think, as you say, you sort of get through and you use your medications as you need, and depending on the complexity of the surgery, as you say, all those patient specific factors. An important thing to remember is that bypass and ECMO has all of those significant complications associated with them. And one of those things is a big hit to the LV and RV following a bypass run. So it'd be very, very rare to use, bypass for a patient for a non-cardiac surgery, maybe ECMO for something that needs to be used where you can't ventilate or something during that case. But a good rule of thumb for bypass cases is that LVEF may be impacted by about 10% following weaning from bypass until you establish normal perfusion and give it time to rest. So, putting a patient with an EF of 10% on bypass is a pretty significant kind of thing to do because it means that the weaning of bypass is going to be very, very complex. And I think in that case, the risk benefit, the harm and the insult that the bypass might do, I think is probably more risky than, giving a big dose of Fent, running your adrenaline or your ephedrine or whatever it might be, giving very, very minimal amounts of drugs versus, trying to put them on an extracorporeal circuit and dealing with all of the complications that arise following that.
Yeah. Actually, so this is actually a really interesting point that probably worthwhile kind of drawing out. So, you get a sick patient in a non-cardiac setting and they've got, let's say it's an urgent operation, some level of urgency, and most elective operations are at some stage going to be a bit more urgent. Sounds like there's no real win here. Like, you really have to decide for this patient at the time, can this patient, do we want this surgery right here, knowing the incredible risks in the perioperative period rather than anything? And that, bypass isn't a win here. It's not like the golden ticket that just gets this patient out of the problem. If you decide to do the anesthetic, you have to take it with all its risks. And this patient has an incredibly high risk, and really they have to go in with the presence of mind or the consent process saying that this is going to be extremely, potentially, 5, 10, 20% mortality in the next 30 days kind of thing. And when you're at the cold front with an urgent procedure, I think one I remember was a neck fast in the groin, we're like, well, we've got to do this because either way, this patient is not going to do too well. So that's really reassuring to hear that, Grant. So either way, you have to kind of crack on and make that decision irrespective of bypass and cardiac anesthesia.
That's right. And I think you've summed it up really well, but it's really a constellation of those, patient anesthetic surgical factors, knowing the patient well and having a good discussion with them and their family members about what their goals of care are, what the potential complications of the surgery are. And as exactly what you've said, I really can't stress that enough, that the availability or the potential to put someone on bypass or ECMO doesn't mean that it's just simply a helicopter out of a difficult situation. There's often the risks and complications associated with that, especially in a sick patient, especially potentially in an emergent or unplanned setting, often outweigh the benefits. The complexity is such that, as you've said, knowing the patient, knowing those factors and having that discussion is probably the most important thing rather than, relying on these technologies that that present their own specific issues.
Yeah, right. Hey, Grant, that's been a really, really great chat. Is there any other things that you find that I may have not asked or missed and are worth mentioning before we wrap it up?
I think, just those things that we talked about initially, I think I've sort of peppered them throughout, but, it's a team sport. Just relying on the people who work around you, your surgeon, your perfusionist, your anaesthetist, whichever role you're taking in that team is super important. Knowing what they're doing and respecting what they're doing is important. And I haven't actually mentioned this yet, but the importance of closed loop communication on the initiation and meaning of bypass is so important. So saying what you're doing, getting that call back to you, and then if someone's, saying what they're doing, calling that back to them as well. So everyone sort of understands they're on the same page. Those human factors are, I think, some of the most important parts of going on and coming off bypass. But I think that's a pretty significant takeaway for anyone going into these theatres.
I think that's really important. I mean, it actually frustrates me. It sounds like you guys are creating the culture where there is that army style closed loop communication. Nothing that is said isn't repeated back with any kind of misunderstanding. I think the time I probably get a bit passive aggressive at sometimes. I say, I'm doing this, and if I don't get an acknowledgement, I say it again until I do it, because I really want to hear the feedback. And surgeons are incredibly task focused, so that's not their natural reaction. I think if, as a junior, the way to practice this is baby, so cesarean section, baby's out. I say giving carbetocin, giving oxytocin, and if I don't get a reply or get a I go, just to clarify, I'm giving, and I just keep saying that until they say yes. And I think we absolutely have to get this as a thing, whether it's with my assistant, my nurse, my junior, my senior surgeon, it has to happen.
Absolutely, because ultimately we're all very good at those specific technical things that we're good at doing as anaesthetists or surgeons or perfusionists, but it's always the interplay and the interface where maybe we don't understand exactly what that other person's doing at that time, or they don't understand what we're doing, and there's a breakdown of those human factors. I think you've hit the nail on the head.
Excellent. Hey Grant, thank you so much for your time. It's funny to think I've been a consultant for this long, and obviously a while since I've done any cardiac anesthesia, but I've learned so much from this chat. So I hope everyone really got a lot out of this. It's been great. Thanks for
Thanks so much to you, Lahiri. Thanks for having me on, and shout out to everyone at the PA hospital, all the great cardiac anesthetists and perfusionists, the surgeons and nurses. Just want to say thanks to those guys, and thank you as well. Thanks for having the podcast and sort of making this accessible for everyone. It's a great service that you do. So thank
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. Oh, thanks, Grant. All the best, and please share this with anyone who might be interested. That's ABCs of Anesthesia on YouTube and on our podcast. And see you next time. Thanks a lot.